Word on Today FM.
You may remember Peter Hanley from things such as Braveheart or Ballykiss Angel. He was a very prominent actor until about a decade and a half ago. And he's making a sort of a class of a comeback, I suppose you could say, as performing in something he has written, What Are You Afraid Of?, which The Rough Magic is showing at the Kilkenny Arts Festival in August. We'll give you more details of that in a little while. Peter Hanley, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Great to be here, Matt.
What Are You Afraid Of? So tell us, what is that about?
Where to start? What are we all afraid of? Where to begin? I worked as an actor, as you say. I've done some screen stuff that people might know that you mentioned. And for theatre goes, I worked around mainly Dublin, sometimes over in Druid, in Galway, in Redcastle, in Waterford, Abbey Gate, Rough Magic. I've worked with them a lot before. Goonanua, Fishamble. In 2011, after a month of rehearsals, as you would normally do, everything had been going fine for a production of Molly Sweeney, Brian Friel play. And it's a monologue play, which is a little bit of an extra challenge for an actor, maybe. It can feel a little bit lonely. And people who've done monologue plays say this. But there were three actors, and I was one of the three. And there's lots of direct address to the audience. I mean, it is purely direct address to the audience. But it was going fine until the dress rehearsal. When it came to my turn, I said to myself, you don't know this. You don't know all these words. How can you possibly know all these words? So in that moment, I was so distracted in that moment, I called for a line. I asked the stage manager to feed me a line, and she did. And then I continued on. And I continued on for the dress rehearsal, all the previews, the opening, the whole run, and never called for a line again. But I feared every moment that I would need to, that I would forget the next line, that it just wasn't there.
You were in a state of fear.
Yeah, for the whole run. And further, I'll raise the stakes. For the next year and a half of shows, I did four more shows. I was in the Gaiety. I was back in the Gaiety a few times.
So you were afraid that you wouldn't be able to remember your lines, that you would be there stuck, not knowing what to say.
Yeah.
Even though you'd learnt everything.
Yeah.
Is that the definition of stage fright?
That's really interesting, because people, when you bring this up, we did at Kilkenny Arts Festival last year, we did a little taster of this. So it's kind of been in the ether. Hopefully there's a bit of anticipation about the show. And actors have said to me, yeah, I get a bit of that, And sometimes I say to myself, a bit? You get a bit? You're still acting, aren't you? I'm being flippant, but yes, it is. It's not uncommon, and but if it's to answer your question, it's not the full definition of it.
Because isn't stage fright about sort of getting out in front of an audience and suddenly being fearful because there's a live audience in front of you, and you're afraid of that. You're afraid specifically of forgetting what it is you're supposed to say and do.
Yeah, you're dead right, and that's a distinction actually that, as I try to explain it to people, they find it hard to get, even actors. So usually, you're right, Matt, usually it's a case of like the sort of fear that people say to actors, how'd you do that? I could never do that. I was best man at my brother's wedding. Oh, I was terrified. Actually, I was best man at my brother's wedding and I was terrified. But that's a different thing. So with me, it is very specific. It's this, because I can stand up in front of people, and I'll be doing that at the Kilkenny Arts Festival, but I will be reading, so we can talk about that more later.
Are you going to use an autocue or a script as such?
Yeah, that's why I'm able to do this, because this problem, it's very much current for me. I'm afraid it's still with me.
Have you tried to have help? Because this is your professional career that's been damaged by it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and it's all in the play, I hope. The questions of, well, who are you if you're not an actor anymore, when it's been something that you identify with and people identify you with. There's that. But there's also then earning a living. That's been huge. And fair play. My wife, Jennifer, has provided for us all for the last decade.
But do you have knock-on effects on that? Does it make you feel depressed, for example, that something that you love doing, that you suddenly feel unable to do it?
Yeah, It does. It lowers my sense of esteem. Yeah, my sense of self-worth. And yeah, I have seen some people. One person in particular, a particular therapist, it didn't work. But again, it's all in the show. And yes, I'll be reading. So I'm going to read from a script, and I'm also going to read from an autocue.
But you have pivoted to an extent, haven't you, in that you've spent your time becoming more of a writer than a performer.
Yeah, it took me a little while, but a year or two. But yeah, I've been writing for at least 10 years, probably 12 years, and I've written several things, but this is the first one to go on.
OK, so if people go to the Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny, 5th to the 9th and the 11th and 12th of August, what are they going to see in What Are You Afraid Of?
Well, they're going to see, I hope a surprisingly funny, honest and accurate an account of what happened to me and the effects of that as we can make. But thankfully, they're not going to do, like when I was thinking of writing this, I thought, okay, what's the first thing? It's me in a script on the stage and, that's a bit boring. I'm not into that, actually. I don't want to present it that way. I want it to be a piece of theatre. It's not a play in the sense of people coming in and out and sitting at a kitchen table and making cups of tea and saying, are you all right, dear? No, I'm not. I still got stage fright today. it's a piece of theatre. It uses direct address to the audience from me. There are lots of other characters in it played by two other actors. There's a kind of a bad angel voice who is a punishing, judgmental voice. And then there's a kind of a good angel character who comes along and actually hands me the script and says, yeah, there you are. I think you need this. And I use it. And later they point out there's an autocue there. OK, I'll use that. And in different ways helps, including provoking me and challenging me to try to get through it. So, and as Lynn, the director, has said quite rightly, they're all my voices. They're all voices from my head.
Okay, and that's Lynn Parker, the director. Okay, let's Peter Hanley get your Culture Club choices. First single that you can remember buying. Can you remember?
Yes, well, thankfully he gave me a bit of warning for this stuff. So I did, it's Oh What a Circus from Evita. It was a single that David Essex sang. And here's one of the many ways today in which I'm a complete imposter. I haven't seen Evita. But and I scribbled some of the dates down here just to position things for me. And actually the dates are kind of important. So it was released in 1978. And within Evita, apparently, it's a response to Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, which was forever on the radio. Elaine Page was in the West End production of Evita. Again, I didn't see the movie. I didn't see the musical on stage. But Oh What a Circus, David Essex sang it. And so I think, Matt, what age? So 78, I was 13. I was born in 65, I was 13. What interested me at the time was, this is kind of musically, in terms of the melody, it's the same melody as Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, but it's got a sort of Latin rhythm. It's sung by a man. It's kind of cool and sexy, and it's a response to Evita. And it begins with that weird Latin prayer.
Let's hear a little bit of David Essex, Oh What a Circus.
That's how to go when they're ringing your curtain down. Demand to be buried like Eva Perón. It's quite a sunset and good for the country. In a roundabout way, we've made the front pages of all the world's papers today. But who is this Santa Evita? Why all this howling, hysterical sorrow? What kind of goddess has lived among us? How will we ever get by without her?
David Essex, who was certainly a bit of a heartthrob in the 70s, if I remember rightly. Okay, favourite albums. You've given us four. I want to talk about one, though, in particular to start. Prefab Sprout and Steve McQueen. Why have you picked that?
Yeah, and all the others are by one particular group, band. And this is quite different. Yeah, a friend introduced me, a friend in Dublin Youth Theatre. After leaving school, I joined Dublin Youth Theatre. It was just around the corner from my school. It was on Gardiner Street. And a friend introduced me to an album called Swoon, which was their first album, by Prefab Sprout, who are from the very north of England. I think it's nearly Scotland. A band formed by a man called Paddy McAloon. Here's my trivia. Is the band, his brother is in it, his girlfriend and his best friend. So he formed it with people very close to him. And he's a wonderful lyricist. So yeah, first album was Swoon. And second was this one, Steve McQueen. And with the famous, I'm just going to forget the name of the song now. We'll come to it in a minute.
When Love Breaks Down.
Exactly. Right there. The unforgettable, what's it called? Yeah, When Love Breaks Down, which was a huge single, and that was on the radio a lot. But I loved all the tracks. I just don't ask me to name them clearly, but I loved them all. It was one of those albums I listened to a lot. It was more, I think it was a bit more poppy, a bit more smooth than Swoon, the first album. But it was still really inventive in terms of his work as a lyricist and the melodic lines as well. Like they were really interesting, really challenging to listen to.
Let's hear a little bit of When Love Breaks Down.
My love and I, we work well together, but often we're apart. Absence makes the heart lose wages. Love breaks down.
Prefab Sprout, When Love Breaks Down, from the album Steve McQueen. But as you mentioned, the other three albums you all gave us were all from your favourite band. And it's quite clear from all the answers you've given me, you're something of a U2 obsessive.
Yeah, someone else said something like that. I suppose I'm probably not anymore, but I was then. And I've probably bought in some form or other all the albums over the years.
But you're very much the 1980s. You're going from War, The Unforgettable Fire, The Joshua Tree. Many people think still their best U2 work, that they never quite beyond the 80s got quite. And a lot of people love their albums from the 90s, but the 80s were where they're at their best, maybe.
Yeah, and all those people who say that, are they all, you know, my age? Possibly. Is it as kind of nostalgia thing? And is it where you were at in your life when you heard them first, and what was going on for you, and you know, did you feel you were with your tribe, and you were all enjoying these albums and going to gigs maybe, and that's kind of how it was with me. Again, a friend introduced me to them. I was never an early adopter or adapter, whatever that is. So a friend at school, Morris, he and again the previous album, so Boy in October, he taped them for me and he gave them to me, and I remember listening to them ad nauseum at home. And then so they kind of blur in my mind for me because I listened to them together. But then War felt very distinctively, the War album in 1983. More rock, a bit more political, a bit angrier maybe, and like just fantastic music, I think, fantastic melodies. And Unforgettable Fire was the first album, I think, that Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois produced, and they did The Joshua Tree as well. And just new sounds all the time. It's funny, you know, people who don't like U2 say, but they all sound the same. And I think, I don't think they do at all. But if it's a music that you're not into, or you haven't sort of steeped yourself in, you think it all sounds the same. But for me, these were really distinctively different and in a lot of ways more sophisticated as it went on. Joshua Tree, like, they're classic songs. on all the albums. And I put them down as my favourite band as well. And I was thinking about this, you know, I mean, yeah, with the Beatles, I'm sure the Beatles are better than you two. I'm sure they are. I'm sure I heard that somewhere. But what matters to me, I guess, in terms of picking favourites for today is how much they meant to me at a certain time.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the album War, New Year's Day. One of the great 1980s tracks, New Year's Day. And then for a best gig, no surprise, you've gone for U2 as well. One of the earlier gigs of the Phoenix Parks Racecourse in 1983. Phoenix Parks Racecourse now gone, covered yes. in housing.
That's right.
Tell us why you remember that one, because that's a long time ago.
Yeah, 1983. And it was, I see from my list here, War came out in 83, so it was the War Tour. The best gig. It was the first gig. And I haven't gone to many gigs in my life. I don't get out that much. I've seen them in Croke Park maybe three times. So I'm not, you know, it kind of waned, the obsession waned a bit. It was great. I remember it. It was great. U2 played, Eurythmics played, U2 topped the bill. Eurythmics played, maybe Big Country. So it was that era, I suppose, when I was listening to a lot of music, a lot of pop and rock music. And I do remember Annie Lennox asking a man to get down off that stand. Would you ever get down? He was standing on the top of the stand and somebody's going to get hurt. You really got to get down. I don't know if Bono minded that or not.
He was probably up there with him. Let's a little bit from that particular gig in the Phoenix Park Racecourse, Out of Control. Early U2, Out of Control from 1983. So, favourite play or theatre show or musical? You've gone for a Marina Carr production, Hecuba. Tell us about this.
Yeah, Hecuba at the Project Arts Centre, adapted by Marina Carr for Rough Magic Theatre Company and directed by Lynn Parker, who I'll be working with on What Are You Afraid Of? I've worked with a lot with the company over the years, and I've seen a lot of their shows. If I'm not in them, I'm watching them. And this was a tangibly wonderful, taut experience. It's the Trojan Wars. It feels, when you walked into the Project Arts Centre to see this production a few years ago, that the dust was literally settling. And there was a wonderful set of designs around this, including sound design, which it just created a wonderful tension before a word was even spoken. The room, because it feels like it's the throne room in Troy. The Greeks have just ransacked and ravaged Troy. And on stage is Hecuba herself, the queen, and a lot of other women, and they're in the shadows in the corners. And so while you're taking your seat, there's already this incredibly taut atmosphere in there. So it's a post-war, immediate to the end of the war, the setting here, and this fear in the air, and yet a kind of a bristling pride and authority from this defeated queen. So I just mentioned two of the actors. I mean, wonderful ensemble. But Aislinn McGuckin played Hecuba, and then soon to arrive on stage as Agamemnon was Brian Doherty, and it's the negotiation, personal, political, that goes on between them, and other characters come into it, particularly her daughters. Not everyone's getting out alive, and it's written by Marina in fantastic, seemingly at times casual, but wonderfully chosen language. It's Hiberno-English. It's language as we speak it. But yet, it's Marina Carr. It's got this wonderful poetry.
Movies, actors, directors. Funny enough, you've given us two movies and two directors, but no actors in your list.
Ah, yeah, that's true.
Well, anyway, the movies you've gone for: John Huston directing The Dead, and also Francis Ford Coppola and The Godfather. Why have you picked those two?
Right. And I'm only realising, I left out the actor. So while we're at it, let's say that Donal McCann was, God rest him, arguably one of the best stage actors the country ever produced.
And he's in The Dead.
And he's in The Dead. Yeah, he played Gabriel Conroy in The Dead. This is, so the American director John Huston directed the adaptation of the James Joyce short story, The Dead, from Dubliners. And it was made and came out in 87, 88, I think. The main characters in that are Gabriel Conroy, played by Donal McCann, and his wife Greta, played by Angelica Huston, a daughter of the director John Huston. Two fantastic performances. Again, it is an ensemble piece. Most of the evening is an evening with these, as I think they were called, spinster sisters, sort of late middle-aged sisters. We're set, by the way, in sort of turn of the 20th century. And they're having, it's Little Christmas or Nulig Naman, and they're having their annual dinner party, and it's kind of formal in a way, in terms of their attire and the food and that, but wonderfully casual in terms of the conversation they have. And it's, there's great comedy in it. Donal Donnelly plays a wonderful comic role in it. Mary Keane, now I started listing people. Mary Keane, Colm Meaney is in it. And it's Dan O'Herlihy. And they talk about music, they talk about politics, they talk about each other's lives. But at the heart of it is this deep melancholy that this man senses in his wife. And it comes out at the end what that is, or something of what that is, when she tells him the story of this boy, this young man, and when she was growing up in the west of Ireland, who died and seemed to die out of love for her. And then we hear his voice, Gabriel, the husband, in voiceover, just talking about questioning, have I ever felt that passion for anything or anyone in my life? And it's, getting moved here. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful short story, and it's a beautiful film.
And then The Godfather, something entirely different.
Well, very moving, The Godfather as well. And sure, while we're at it, let's say Al Pacino is one of the best actors. And no, I do love Al Pacino in this. Yeah, The Godfather.
Well, actually, let's just hear a clip. Al Pacino as Michael Corleone and Richard S. Castellano in The Godfather.
What's the matter? The trigger too tight?
Oh, my ears.
Yeah, I left it noisy. That way it scares any pain in the ass, innocent bystanders away. All right, you shot them both. Now what do you do?
Sit down, finish my dinner.
Come on, kid, don't fool around. Just let your hand drop to your side and let the gun slip out. Everybody will still think you got it. They're going to be staring at your face, Mike. So walk out of the place real fast, but you don't run. Don't look nobody directly in the eye, but you don't look away either. Hey, they're going to be scared stiff of you, believe me. So don't worry about nothing. You know, you're gonna turn out all right. You take a long vacation, nobody knows where, and we're gonna catch the hell.
How bad do you think it's gonna be?
Pretty goddamn bad. Probably all the other families will line up against us. That's all right. This isn't gonna happen every 5 years or so. 10 years. Helps to get rid of the bad blood. Been 10 years since the last one. You know, you gotta stop them at the beginning. Like they should have stopped Hitler at Munich. They should never let him get away with that. They was just asking for big trouble. You know, Mike, we was all proud of you being a hero and all. Your father, too.
The Godfather. Now, tell us a little bit about why you love that.
I think there's a restraint to it. It's a crime family. They do awful things. But they are a father and brothers, and sons and daughter, so are you on their side or not? That's almost not relevant. They're fascinating people. I mean, some are. You know, James Caan's character is a kind of wild, short tempered, violent man, and Al Pacino's character Michael is much more interesting and sophisticated. But largely, they're very interesting. What's going on with this family and the formality of their clothing? They did a lot of dark interiors in the film, but it's got a great restraint because behind all of this is their power, and they're doing awful things. They're running prostitution rackets and gambling and protection rackets and all sorts of things. But you see the front of it, and now and then you see what they will do out of hunger for power and out of loyalty to the family above everything. And it's very interesting as well how Al Pacino, it seems as if he nearly escapes going into the family business, but doesn't.
For favourite books and authors, anything by Michael Connelly, he was here, I think it must be 10 years ago now at this stage, his brilliant Bosch detective novels and various other things. Anne Enright. But tell us a little bit about Maggie O'Farrell, because she was in here when she brought out Hamlet. And why have you picked that out?
It feels like a bit like sort of, you know, the other two, like the films I mentioned as well, and the play. There's an authenticity about it. And yet it's a world we know only so much about. There's a book written about Shakespeare himself. So this is Hamlet was the name of Shakespeare's son who died young. The Bill Bryson book about Shakespeare says, it begins by saying, we know remarkably little about the life of Shakespeare, but here's my book anyway. So what Maggie O'Farrell has done is imagined a lot of it, extrapolated, based a lot on fact. And it turns out it's really about Hamlet's mother, in a sense. I mean, it's about the family, but it's about William Shakespeare as well. But it's about her. And she's a kind of a herbalist. She's a healer. She's a sort of pharmacist of the time. There's a kind of wildness to her. I have to admit, it's been a while since I read it. But so what stays with me are things like the feel of, you know, the herbs she's dealing with, the feel of the leather. Shakespeare's father was a glove maker. So the way she describes things like the leather there in the shop where I think William is being, you know, expected to go into the family business, but doesn't want it. That's a familiar theme. But there's a real earthiness and etherealness, if you can have both, to Anne Hathaway, Anna, I think she's called in the book, that which I loved.
Okay, we haven't much time left. Yeah. Television. What used you watch as a child, as a teenager?
Yeah, I wrote a long list, so I won't go. Yeah. Fawlty Towers, again, it's a bit like U2, the first music, the first band, the first gig. Fawlty Towers, the first time I fell around laughing at home. Later, I saw reruns of Monty Python, not the 9 o'clock news was going around that time. And then much later, I think Father Ted is wonderful. But as a first, Fawlty Towers was just, it was like that character played by John Cleese could do anything. There was kind of a danger to the comedy. Anything might happen. Will it go through a couple of them?
Yeah, well, just a few, because we are tight on time.
Sure.
I just say things. I see you've got for modern day the wonderful Happy Valley with Sarah Lancashire, which was Lancaster, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
Ripley.
Yeah, wow. Yeah,
the black and white.
Incredible. Again, full of great atmosphere. You can smell it. You can feel it. Andrew Scott Wonderful performance.
And White Lotus, did you enjoy the last series of White Lotus as much as the previous ones?
No, I haven't seen it. That's number three, isn't it? I'm afraid I haven't. I don't have whatever platform it's on at the moment. So one and two I loved. I have to see three yet.
We'll see if you like that as much. Okay, we always finish with what we call a cultural buried treasure, something that you recommend that you think is often overlooked. And you've gone for a 1955 movie called...
The Lady Killers.
What's this?
I think there was a stage adaptation that Hugh Linehan did, so I'm not talking about that. Or I don't any other remake. No, I'm talking about the original. So 1955, it was one of a few Ealing comedies. Ealing Studios made these comedies in the 50s. The Lavender Hill Mob was another one. Kind Hearts and Coronets. And this is a film I didn't share much with my father in terms of the sort of things we would watch or like or... But this was one that we did as a family. We watch a lot of these Ealing comedies. Alec Guinness is the lead in it. They're a gang of criminals. So it's a comedy. It's a very funny film. They're a gang of criminals. They rent a room in this little old lady's house, pretending to be a little musical ensemble. Instead of practicing, they put on a record. So when she's outside the door, she can listen to the music and say, oh, gorgeous. They're planning a heist. They're planning a robbery. It doesn't go well. They don't all get out alive. It's very funny.
We have to leave it there, Peter Handley. We are out of time. What Are You Afraid Of is premiere from the Rough Magic at the Kilkenny Arts Festival. It's on the 5th to the 9th and also the 11th and 12th of August in the Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny. It'll be directed by Lynn Parker. Peter Handley, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us this evening. That's it. A big thank you to my entire production team, led tonight by Dermot Doyle. We have Paula McSweeney up next, back tomorrow at 4:30. Until then, for me, Matt Cooper, have a very good evening.
The Last Word on Today FM.